Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. And as the temperatures continue to climb and you start tinkering around the garden, you might find under the melted snow, or under the melting snow, some damaged plants and shrubs. Our guest today has some advice on how to handle that and deal with it, among other things. She's Diana Offuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She's been with us a number of times. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. And you can get your questions to her at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. Diana, thank you for spending time with us today.
It's great to be here.
Wonderful having you with us. Well, kind of a brutal winter this past year, and some parts of our state are still digging out, as you well know. What about those shrubs and bushes that might have been damaged? How do you tell if a bush or shrub has been, let's say, irreparably damaged?
Well, that's kind of on a case-by-case basis. But obviously, we have evergreen shrubs and we have deciduous shrubs. And a lot of them were just flattened with snow because the snow piles and the drifts were so big. We had a 5-foot-tall Tinkerbell lilac that you absolutely could not even see the tip of at one point this winter because the drift was so high over it. And now that the snow is receding and it's not totally gone yet, we can see that a lot of those center branches have cracked and they're broken off. So the first thing to think is, you know, don't be in any hurry to get out there, especially in the northern part of the state. We have a lot of wet, soggy grass yet.
Yeah.
And it's best if you're not out there as hard as it is, because we all want to get out there and see what's going on. It's best if you're not out there walking on that grass, because when that soil is wet like this, walking on it compacts it. So it's best to stay off till it dries a little bit. And the other thing is that with a lot of these things, you're going to have to really get in there and inspect what was broken and be patient and see what comes back. So so certainly if anything's broken, it's going to have to be removed. Things you always prune away are anything that's dead, dying, or diseased. And if it's broken off, it's going to need to be pruned back. But you're going to have to evaluate each shrub and see what's going to be left once you prune away those broken things.
Yeah.
Some things like my lilac will sprout up from the crown again. So removing those big branches, maybe shaping it a little bit. Remember that pruning causes growth, so that will cause new shoots to come up, and it might take a year or two for that shrub to get a good shape again, but those plants can recover. If it's something that has just a single stem on it and that single stem is cracked, it may be time to replace it. But I would wait. On a lot of these things, we aren't going to know until mid-May, early June even, when the buds are breaking and the leaves are coming out, just how severe the damage is. So don't be in a hurry. It's still a good excuse to be lazy and stay in the house.
All right. Well, what about all the salt and sand? Gosh, there was a lot of it used this past year. Does it have an impact on our lawns and our plants and our other landscapes?
It does. And salt is a desiccant, so it dries out plants. So it kind of, in some ways, you can think of it as causing drought damage to the plants. And it can do it in two ways. If you drive down I-94, especially up in Pierce and St. Croix counties, you see all these brown evergreens. And that's from salt spray kicking up. It's amazing down the interstate with the cars going fast how far that salt spray goes. And especially this winter, it was really windy, it seems.
Yeah.
So that was blowing it even farther. So you'll notice plants that are damaged from salt spray, they're brown on only one side, the side that the salt spray comes from. And a lot of those, the needles are brown. They're usually reddish brown. But those trees will come back because the buds at the ends of the branches aren't killed, okay? Now, if they really got sprayed, those buds might be killed and then they won't get any growth. But again, it's kind of one of those things that we have to wait and see. The other way that salt bothers shrubs and all plants is it gets into the soil. So if it's an area like next to a sidewalk where you salt a lot and then that melts and it runs off into the soil, it can burn the roots and it can dry out the roots. And so then you can get total dieback or some dieback from the tips of the branches. And again, you'll get the symptoms that are similar to drought stress because water's not getting to the tips of those branches.
Sure.
again, that's the kind of thing that we're not going to know the extent of it really until the new growth is really getting active. And that may be, you know, depending on what part of the state you're in, it might be early May, it might be early June. So if you have some brown tips on evergreens, if you have some ends of branches that, especially like broadleaf evergreens, like rhododendrons and stuff, you might lose a lot more of those leaves this year, but the best advice is to just wait and see once those plants start growing what's still there. Then you can prune away anything that's dead and shape the shrub, but don't be in a hurry.
Don't be in a hurry. Well, is that does that apply to getting plants back outside after being inside all winter?
Are you talking about limey or lime tree?
I'm thinking about limey. Limey is just producing limes like to beat the band. But limey liked being outside last summer.
Sure. And, you know, whatever winter was, spring and summer weather is still unknown. So especially a plant that's been overwintered inside, it's just like any other winter where we just have to watch what the forecast is. Don't get things out too soon. Right now, because the frost, like up in our area, was so cold, was so deep this year that a lot of villages and cities and stuff had people running their water constantly because water lines were freezing up. So the frost was really, really deep. So this winter, being that cold, it might take longer for that soil to warm up enough to be putting anything in the ground outside.
Yeah.
So this is the time of year that you really should have a soil thermometer. And before you go planting your tomatoes or before you go planting anything in the ground, checking the temperature of the soil in your yard, because it can vary dramatically depending on what kind of soil you have and how much moisture is in the soil and that kind of a thing. But if it's a house plant, obviously you just want to make sure the nights aren't too cold for it and the days are what limey and your other house plants would like.
I've got an instant read meat thermometer. A food thermometer. I wonder if that'll work for.
It might, but a lot of those meat. A soil thermometer looks just like a meat thermometer, but a lot of the meat thermometers don't go down as low. They don't go down to 30 or 40 degrees. A lot of those start, you know, up at 80, 90 degrees, so they don't go low enough.
They go low enough.
But you can get soil thermometers in garden centers and online and stuff, and it's really, I always tell people, you know, put it on your Christmas wish list. That's a great gift for somebody to give a gardener, is a soil thermometer. And, you know, even if the air temperature, like tomatoes, for example, that like warm weather, even if the air temperature in the daytime is warm and the nights are not freezing, if you put your tomato plant out in cold soil, it just kind of sits there and gets shocked and shivers and it doesn't grow.
Yeah, doesn't like it.
No. So it's really, and it's amazing how much it takes to warm up the soil. So even if it's 80 degrees outside, that soil might still be 40 degrees. And this year, you know, it might take a while for it to warm up and get to where we want it to be.
Well, I've got a very expensive, it was a gift, instant read thermometer. And I'm going to stick that in the refrigerator just to see if it goes down low enough. Oh, my goodness. Well, we have callers online. You can join in, by the way, if you have a question for Diana Alfuth, our horticulture educator from Pierce County with UW Extension. I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Love that. Send us some photos at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And we have Catherine from Stevens Point on board and with a question I think relates to what we've been talking about, I believe. Catherine, hi.
Hi, how are you, Larry?
Great.
It sure does. I've been listening carefully. I'm looking out my kitchen window at a bonsai pine or evergreen that I've had for 20 years. And it was doing really well, but this was very cold winter. And so the bottom half that was buried in snow looks just fine. The top half looks very brown. And those bonsais, you know, they're kind of like puffs, like little areas. And I don't know what I can do to help it along.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not really anything you can do. At this point, those needles are brown. Depending on how, again, we won't really know how bad the damage is until things get growing. But at this point, you can't, you know, watering it's not going to help. Don't fertilize it. You know, our instinct so often is to fertilize things, but fertilizer is most often a salt, and so that can cause more desiccation. And we don't necessarily want it. Fertilizer might push growth, and that might not really be what we want either. So don't go dumping fertilizer on it either at this point. What you might have is what I mentioned earlier, where the buds on the ends of those branches, even though the branches are brown, the buds are still alive. And they'll start growing, and they'll put on their new growth when the season warms up here enough.
Should I trim off the brown, or should I like try to shake them off, or just leave it alone?
Right now, I would leave it alone.
Okay.
What might happen is if those needles are if they're really brown and they're not going to come back at all, but you get new growth on the ends of the buds, they'll start to kind of want to fall off on their own. At that point, you know, you might shake them off just so you don't have to look at them as much.
Okay.
But unfortunately, being a bonsai plant like that with those little puffs and stuff, that's, you know, it's going to change the whole look of that shrub, unfortunately. And you'll just have to see if it's still something you can live with. If it's a pine type of plant, it doesn't have the latent buds that'll, you know, where you prune it all off and it's going to shoot back up and fill out.
Oh, the candles, you mean? I get the candles that I have to pinch off every year.
Right, and those are mostly at the ends of the branches?
Right.
Yeah, so that's where the growing points are on pines versus like spruce or yews or arborvitae. They have buds further back, so you can shear them and then those buds will come out. You can't really do that with pines. You just end up with a stub of a branch, so they don't fill in very well. But my suggestion would be to just wait on it. Wait until new growth is coming out on it as well as other evergreens in the area, and then kind of see what you have left. And certainly you can shake off any brown needles that aren't falling on their own. And then, like I said, kind of have to just decide if it's still something you want to look at.
Yeah. There you go, Kat.
And I have one other quick question. In front of my house, I have hydrangeas, and I'm beginning to call them endlessly disappointing.
Yes. Rather than endless summer.
That has been a disappointing.
Beautiful growth, but they don't get a lot. And I prune them properly. I get a few big blue flowers, but not a lot. And it's a problem area because I get a lot of snow off the house. So what I had before was always smashed down. So they're a perfect plant. But is there anything else I could put there if I get fed up with those endless summers?
Endless summer has been a real disappointment, especially in the northern part, the northern half of the state. If they do bloom, they're very short. They die back much more than they were supposed to. And I've seen a few nice ones, but for the most part, people are disappointed. Did you say it's a sunny spot?
No, it's a north. It's kind of northwest corner. I get a little sun, but not a lot. Okay. I looked at Limelight hydrangeas, but I think they need a lot of sun.
There's a new hydrangea out that's kind of it's supposed to be an improvement on Endless Summer, and I am not going to remember the name of it. But it will get purple or pink. I'm not going to remember that.
A new hybrid?
Yes, and it's supposed to solve some of the problems that Endless Summer had. So you might look into that.
I'll ask around at the garden centers and see if they know.
It should be out there this year. And you don't get 6 hours of sun a day.
Not in that area.
Because otherwise, a lot of times for places that get flattened by snow, if there's enough sun, a lot of the shrub roses are great options for that because they can get broken off at the ground and they shoot up from the ground and they bloom on new wood. And so those can be good options, but it doesn't sound like you have enough sun there. So
good luck.
Yeah.
Look up that. And we might be, somebody will probably phone in the name of that new hydrangea anyway. We'll find out. Thanks, Catherine. Looking at your garden today with our guest, Diana Alfuth, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Diana Alfuth, horticulture educator from Pierce County and UW Extension. Jill in Rhinelander has a question for you. Diana, let's go to Jill. Hi, thank you for calling. Jill, are you there? Whoops.
Jill, I just have two beautiful maple trees in my front yard. And when I came, I noticed in the fall that they had real large black spots on the leaves. Can you tell me if there's anything I could do now, or is it too late, or...
No, nothing really to do, is there, Diana?
No. So did they look like tar splotched on the leaves?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's called tar spot of maple, a real creative name for it. But it's a fungal disease that gets on the leaves. Really, it's harmless to the tree. Usually we see it on silver maples. I don't know what kind of maples you have, but it's most common on silver maples, sometimes red maples. But it's really just a cosmetic thing. And some years it'll be worse than others, depending on weather.
Last year was a bad year for it.
Was it?
Yeah.
And
terrible.
Okay, and again, it has to do with moisture and temperatures and all that kind of thing. And by the time you're seeing those black blotches on the leaves, the infection had occurred probably a month earlier when the fungal spores landed on the leaves and started growing and stuff. And then it's not until it progresses enough that the leaf spot shows up. So by that point, there's nothing you can do about it. About all I would suggest, you're not going to be continuously every 7 to 10 days spraying your big maple trees with fungicides to prevent it. That's not realistic. So the best thing you can do is rake up infected leaves in the fall so that those spores aren't around as much come springtime. Because what they do is they overwinter on those leaves and the spores fly out in early summer and they land on the new young leaves and they take hold and then you get another crop of these black spots. And it depends on what the weather is at that timing. So it's harmless to the tree. It's a cosmetic thing that we have to look at. But other than trying to clean up fallen leaves, there's not really much you can do about it.
Nope. There you go, Jill. Thanks for calling. Barb in Stevens Point, we turn to you next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Diana.
Hey, Barb.
Hi. We have deer that had a path in our front yard this winter. And I planted a yew shrub last year because they told me at the garden center that deer would not eat it. Well, it's now about 13 inches high and 21 inches wide, a little brown at the tip, otherwise it's still pretty green. I'd just like to know, what do I need to do to make sure that it survives?
Well, you know, I have a sister-in-law that has a similar problem to this, and Extension has a publication that I always chuckle at. It's called Plants Not Favored by Deer. It doesn't say deer-proof plants because there is no such thing. And if they're hungry enough and...
They'll eat anything.
Right, and they will nibble on anything. So what you'll have... How much did they chew it down? You said it's about 13 inches high. What was it before winter?
Well, I just bought it last year, so it wasn't really tall. I'd say maybe there was maybe about, I'm thinking maybe 5 or 6 more inches above that.
Okay. Well, the good thing is that yews have buds further back on the stem. So that's why they can take shearing and they can be sheared into hedges and that kind of a thing. So kind of the deer did a little shearing for you, but... That shrub should recover just fine. There should be buds farther back that'll break. You might want to shape it a little if it's really a awful looking shape and stuff. And hopefully now that things start greening up, the deer will be eating other things and not go after the yew. But if you have a path through your front yard like that, then it's kind of like the McDonald's drive-through restaurant window for the deer. So next year you might have the same problem. And about the only thing to do, you can use repellents, but that gets putsy. They don't always work. The best thing to do is if you know they're going to target a plant is put some kind of barrier up. So just, a little fence of chicken wire over it or burlap or anything that just makes it really hard for them to get at it so that they can't eat it. You know that they know it's there. They'll remember it next year probably.
Now, the brown tips, when can that be cut off? I mean, there's not too many, but otherwise the shrub is pretty green. Can I cut those brown tips off now, or should I wait?
I would wait because tips, the buds at those tips, you just never know what's going to grow, what's going to be green. Okay. So there's no reason to really hurry about it. Use you can really prune any time of year if you want to. So wait until things get green and growing and you are sure what's dead, because you don't want to prune away something that would otherwise be alive and put on growth for you.
Yep. There you go. Good luck, Barb. Thank you. And Joe in Oconomowoc, great to have you with us. Hello.
Thanks. It's Joe. Thanks for taking my call. But my question has to do with, I have about 40,000 square feet of lawn right now. I want to turn it into prairie flowers. And I'm being told that I have to kill the lawn with Roundup or some kind of herbicide in order to do that or have it tilled. It's really close to the Bark River, and I've kept my land pretty much organic. They farm alfalfa and different stuff on it. I wanted to know, if I just overseeded the current lawn with the prairie flowers, would I have, you know, decent success in that kind of an approach?
No. Yeah. The problem is that lawn grass is, it has all the rhizomes and stolons on it, so it forms that sod kind of a thing, and that will choke out any of your prairie flowers. Plus, your prairie flower seeds need to have soil-to-seed contact in order for those seeds to germinate. So one way or another, you've got to get the seeds to land on bare soil. Okay, and that sod-forming grass stuff, it's established, and it's going to grow up faster, especially in the spring, because most of our lawn grasses are cool-season grasses, so they start greening up early. Prairie flowers are warm-season plants. They don't get going until the soil gets to a nice warm temperature. We're talking about late May, early June before they even start to grow. In the meantime, that lawn grass is going to be choking them out, so you're not going to get much success. What you'll get is a what looks like a weedy lawn, because the few prairie flowers that do make it will look like weeds in a lawn.
You really need to get the grass and weeds out of there.
Now, if you're worried about the water...
Go ahead, Dan. I'm sorry.
If you're worried about the water, Roundup is toxic to fish and other aquatic wildlife, but it's not the glyphosate active ingredient in there that's toxic. It's the carrier that's in Roundup. So you can get fish-safe glyphosate, and usually it's marketed as like cattail killer and stuff like that, so you can use that and not have to worry so much about, you know, damaging anything, any of the aquatic fish or animals in the water. And glyphosate is a pretty it's a pretty mild herbicide in that it only kills what it comes in contact with. And once it hits the soil, it pretty much breaks down within a couple of days. So it's not something that persists in the soil and is going to run off or you know, seep down into the water and that kind of thing. There's just not been any evidence of that happening. And glyphosate has been around for a long time now. So it's really a kind of thing, you spray it on once. Anything green it comes in contact with, it gets into that plant, goes down, kills that plant and the root, but then it's pretty much gone. So it's not as evil as, you know, maybe some other herbicides go, but it's really the only way. Now, tilling it, you could till it, but what you'd have to do is take about a whole year where you till it up and the next week you till it again. Anytime any little grass plant starts shooting up green, and it will because of that extensive root system, you have to till it up so that you starve the plants out. But it's not a one-time thing. It's not even a 3 or 4 time thing in my experience. It's pretty much you do it all year and plant next spring.
That's really not an option. So I think... So if I use the more effective or the more safe herbicide, I could do that this year? I could spray it now? I have to wait till the grass is green? Or what's the
You have to wait until the plants are actively growing. So, yes, the grass would have to be green. And usually it's best if you do it twice. Okay, so because there's always something that's going to not have been hit
emerge
by the first
later
dose.
Or something.
Right, or it was hiding under another leaf or something like that. So if you do it, the thing with glyphosate is it actually kills the plant within a couple of days, but the plant doesn't show it. So when you spray it, it's going to look green for a week yet, and you're going to go, oh my gosh, it didn't work, you know. But then after 10 days or so, things will start going off color and start dying. So spray it once and then wait 2 to 3 weeks and then spray it again. And then you should get pretty good kill off. And then you'll still have to till it a little bit again to get some soil out there before you plant. But you can be planting prairie flowers and prairie grasses in the middle of June. So it's not like, you know, you're in any super hurry to get that planted because, again, they're warm season plants. They like warm soil and, you know, they'll have plenty of time.
You might go to there's some websites like Prairie Nursery has a very good website that has a lot of really good information on planting and care and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Of course, they sell seed, too. But, they have a lot of good educational material on there that I think you might find worthwhile, Jill.
Yep. It'll talk about the whole step-by-step process on establishing a prairie.
And I would bet there are. Prairie Enthusiasts is another organization.
Oh, yeah.
You might go to Prairie Enthusiasts, their website, and you're going to find a lot of good information there as well. And even maybe somebody locally in the Oconomowoc area is a member of Prairie Enthusiasts, and oftentimes I think they're usually plenty happy to offer advice.
And I'm not familiar with Oconomowoc. It's kind of far from home for me. But if there are any native plant nurseries in the area, they also would probably be a good source to help you with that.
Yep. Good luck, Joe. Thank you for calling. We have lots of callers online. So, Mark in Hudson, you're next. Hi,
Mark. I have a question on trimming cherry trees, the Meteor, Montmorency, North Star, the sour cherries.
Yeah.
What's the right technique to trim a mature cherry tree?
With almost all of the fruit trees, it's going to be very similar to the advice for pruning an apple tree. So what we want is an open canopy so that air gets through and sunlight gets through, because that's going to increase your fruit production. You're not going to have a central leader like you do with a landscape plant. The saying is, you know, a bird should be able to fly through your tree without hitting branches and leaves and stuff. So you'll want to look at that structure to create horizontally branched leaves, because upright stuff doesn't grow as or doesn't produce as much. And having that open canopy, anything that's a crossing branch that's going to rub on another branch should go. Anything that's a water sprout type of thing where it shoots up from the trunk and is growing straight up really fast growth, that should go, because that's never really going to produce fruit good. So, again, it's pretty much the same as pruning an apple tree and getting the light into the middle so that you get lots of those yummy cherries.
Yep.
Can I cut off some 1-inch, 2-inch, and 3-inch branches with a handsaw to stimulate it?
You can definitely, and pruning causes growth, so that, but you can always cut off 1 and 2 and 3 inch branches if you have a reason to. But when you say to stimulate it, why do you think you need to stimulate it? Are you not getting fruit?
I have a lot of major structure. I don't have a lot of minor structure that's less than 1, 2, and 3 years old that produces fruit.
Okay. So do you fertilize your tree?
Yeah, they get a shot of 10-10-10 once a year.
Okay. So you're right. Pruning off will cause growth. The problem is sometimes you get those water sprouts again, and that's not the kind of growth that you
yeah.
want. But the other thing is, do you have any kind of suckers growing up on the bottom of the tree?
None.
Okay.
Good.
Okay. Because those can sap the canopy as well. But
yeah,
the rule is that you never prune more than a third of the tree away at a time. So when you're looking at which branches to take off and stuff, cherries can handle some pretty severe pruning, but make sure that you're not removing more than a third at a time, or that'll really stress the tree too much.
Okay.
All right.
Question 2, winter hardy grasses. When you plant grass seed in northern Wisconsin in the St. Croix County area, what are good candidates for winter hardy grasses?
The two that we look at are Kentucky bluegrass and fescue. You get into creeping ryegrass and creeping red fescue, those are not necessarily that hardy. So Kentucky bluegrass for full sun situations, fescue for shadier areas. Fescue is a little more drought tolerant than Kentucky bluegrass, and you can always put in a mix of the two, and then it kind of shakes out on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Mark. Yeah, I like the combination. The mixes, I think, are... Mm-hmm.
Then if you have some shady spots, like a tree in your yard or whatever, the fescue might take over a little bit under the tree, but it all blends together nice.
Yep. Philip in Burnett County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, say, the consensus in Burnett County is that there probably isn't a lot of frost in the ground up here, even though it's been a very cold, as we know, a very cold winter. The snow, we got snow early on, and it was really deep. And I think the places where the frost went down deep is where the snow was plowed on the roads.
Right.
Yep.
And I think what we're finding right now is that the ground is really thawed out already.
Well, that's great. I know in St. Croix County, we had reports that the frost where there was snow was 38 inches deep at one time, and where there was no snow, where it was plowed, it was as much as 8 feet deep in spots. And that was highway department guys who were out there, you know, trying to dig holes and stuff. So it is probably spotty, and it also depends on soil conditions, soil moisture levels going into winter, soil whether it's sandy or clay, and certainly if it's in the sun or the shade. So spotty. Definitely.
Yeah, I was just out with in the woods with my tractor, and I was right into the mud. There's still 2 feet of snow out there, but underneath that snow, it's mud.
No. So stay off of there, Phil.
Yeah. Okay. Good luck.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh yeah, when you got that wet soil underneath. You're compacting.
You always get mud season, I have horses, so we certainly deal with mud season, and it's an easy way to tell how the frost is coming out of the ground by how deep they're sinking in the paddock. But if it is in a yard or garden, you're right, Larry, you want to leave that soil alone, because working with wet soil or walking on wet soil, it squishes out the little air pockets, and you end up with cakey stuff on your shoes and bad soil structure.
Mike in Winchester has a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Say, I got a Canadian cherry tree, and it's just a beautiful tree. It blossoms like crazy in the spring. And this is about the third year in a row now, I've been getting a kind of a growth on the branches, and it's like a black char.
Mm-hmm.
Must be some kind of a fungus or some sort. And I'd snipped them off the last couple of years, and this year it seems like there's even more of it this year.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and it's like right in the middle of the branches. It could be right in the middle. It's not on, doesn't seem like it's on the ends. It's just, but it's almost like it's charred.
Yep. It's called black knot, and it is a fungus. Brian Huddleston, our state plant disease diagnostician, calls it poop on a stick because...
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Dried up black poop, yeah.
Yeah, and it is a fungal thing that gets on there, and there's really nothing you can do about it other than exactly what you were doing is pruning it away. Canadian cherry is highly susceptible to it. It's one of the worst, but you'll see it, you know, driving through the countryside. You'll see it on the little plum trees that are growing in the ditches and stuff. And sometimes it gets really big clumps of it. It doesn't outright kill the tree, but as it progresses, it can girdle that branch. And so then everything beyond that growth will die off. So pruning it out before it sends out spores that can infect other parts of the plant is about all you can do. But when you have a tree like yours that's highly susceptible to it, you don't know what the neighbors have or what the wild plums are in the area that are a source of those spores and everything. It's going to be a continuing battle. And eventually, you know, that tree's maybe not going to be in your yard anymore because it's going to get so ugly looking. And then you can plant it with a different tree that's resistant but mm-hmm. still has pretty flowers.
There you go.
Okay. Well,
sorry.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And not the happiest news, but there you have it. Jim in Lincoln County. Hello.
Hi there. I'm pulling over to make it quieter. Thank you for the informative show. I'm wondering about that glyphosate and plant. After everything dies off, can one plant open pollinated corn in that patch?
Sure. You can plant anything in that patch. Once it dies down, like I said, glyphosate doesn't get in the soil. And although, now that I said, okay, glyphosate doesn't get in the soil, but if you buy Roundup, there's Roundup and then there's Roundup Extend or Extended. Make sure you read the label well, because Roundup has another formulation that has another herbicide in it that actually does get in the soil, and it's meant to keep something from getting weedy all summer long or for 3 months, and make sure you don't use the wrong one. But usually there's when you treat with glyphosate with Roundup, you read the label and see what the interval is for replanting in there, and it'll vary a little bit depending on the formulation by the brand. So glyphosate, there's lots of different companies that package it. And so you just, you know, find what's on the shelf in your garden center and stuff. But usually it's not very long. You know, it might be as much as 3 days. It might be a little bit longer than that. But you can plant anything in that soil once what is there has been killed off, because it doesn't stay in the soil.
There you go.
But one other question for follow-up. Does that stuff, in even the most simple form, would not be a part of any organic label, right?
No, glyphosate is not for certified organic kind of things. You can't use glyphosate on your soil for an organic operation.
No. There you go, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're visiting today with Diana Alfuth, who is the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Really great to have you along today as we talk about, well, gardening and about the harsh winter and how it's affected our plants. Certainly interested in taking your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Actually, I have one or two open lines, so we can get you on fairly soon. George in Green Bay up next with a question. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Oh, thank you. It's great. Science Friday and Garden Talk. What a great day. My question is, we're moving from one home to another, and I have a lot of stuff that I've been moving, everything from rhododendrons to miniature weeping spruce to columnar apple trees and roses. And I was wondering about what general advice you might have for us along that line. And that was it.
Do you, when are you, are you under some time constraints?
Not really. You know, I mean, the one house will list. No, not really.
Okay.
Not at all.
Well, with
a beautiful world, we're not under restraint.
I wonder what that's like. with woody plants, any woody plants, trees, shrubs, all that thing, the best time to move them is when they're dormant. Okay, so they're still dormant right now, at least in most areas. But I have been seeing some buds starting to green up and everything. So anything that you can move while it, before it's leafed out, before the buds have broke, that's a good thing to do. Otherwise, what happens is when the leaves are out, when you move them, no matter how careful you are and how big of a hole you dig, you always leave a big portion of roots behind. So when you transplant them, they first have to grow roots. And if they don't have enough roots and the leaves are out and the leaves are exposed to the sun and trying to grow and losing water, that's when it really stresses the plants. So if you can't get things done before they leaf out now, you can do it again in fall once they start, you know, once they go dormant and stuff. Now, another option, if you don't have time to wait until fall, would be to dig those things up and put them in big containers right now. So transplant them into containers, and then you can, you know, get them growing, let them leaf out and baby them along a little bit, and then you can plant them pretty much any time later in the summer once they kind of let them get established a little bit in the pot and before you transplant them out again. But that's another option.
Would the pot be better than taking part of the land, the new one, and just turning it all over and planting them in there?
I'm sorry.
Would it be better, or could it work the same as a pot, if we were to take and till over a large space at the new house
Oh. Put them in there temporarily.
Sure.
So we move them.
Yep, just like a holding time. Like a holding area. So sure. You get them moved now, yeah. And then you can move them again in fall or next spring when you're ready to know exactly where you want them.
Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. That would work that way then.
Yep, that would work as well. As long as, again, you know, you try to get them moved now when they're still dormant, yeah. And get them established so they can kind of grow during the summer like they normally would. And that's definitely an option as well.
And the temperature of the soil now, moving them, because it's probably the same in either spot, wouldn't be an issue then either, right?
Shouldn't be. No, shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right,
thanks a lot for calling. I'm just flashing back to a trip to Tucson once, and there was a golf course going in, and there were all these saguaro cactus plants that a lot of them had to be moved. And they had a garden of saguaro cactus. I mean, just a big plot. It was all saguaro cactus. They did their work landscaping, and then they put them back where they wanted to put them.
Sure.
And so same thing here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Same thing here.
Just a little temporary home.
We have Phil in Wanakee next with a question. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon. Well, I guess not yet. But, interesting program. In fact, I just went to the store and picked up my crabgrass prevention fertilizer stuff to put down. And I'm reading through my consumer reports. I just got in the mail, and they're talking about the alternative from a chemical herbicide to using corn gluten meal. And I'm going, I've never heard of this before. Where do you get this?
Oh.
It's been going around for a while now, Phil.
Yep, it's been around. It was discovered at, I think, University of Iowa, kind of by accident, that corn gluten meal, which is the byproduct of the corn milling process. I think when they take out corn oil or something and it's something left behind. And it has been found to stop seeds from germinating or to kill off seeds as soon as they germinate. So it kind of works the same way as the chemical version. It's maybe slightly less effective, whereas, you know, maybe like 90% effective versus 100% effective. But it's been around for quite a while. You can get it in a lot of the bigger garden centers. In fact, I don't know if you're familiar with Preen, which is...
Yep.
So they have an organic or a vegetable garden version, and basically what it is corn gluten meal.
It's a powder?
It's like a granular. So it's similar to the granular pieces that in your crabgrass preventer that you can put in a spreader and spread it on your lawn. And and then you kind of water it in, and it starts decomposing, and it has a very effective control of stopping weed seeds from germinating. Now, what I have seen is that it's like the first year you put it on your lawn, you'll get like 70% control, and then the next year you'll get like 85% control, and then the next year, you know, it kind of builds up over time, the control of it. But I guess the other question is, how can we get you to not have crabgrass in the first place? Because if you get your lawn nice and healthy and you raise your lawnmower deck really high up there, you shouldn't have a recurring problem with crabgrass.
It started a couple of years ago, and during the drought part.
Okay, sure.
That's when it started, and it's really got bad last year, and I'm going,
yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm going to try to kill it with the crabgrass preventer, but then I've never heard that anything really.
Yeah.
Works too well.
And that's a good point. You know, if your lawn got thinned out in the drought, then the crabgrass gets in. And then if it's allowed to go to seed, you have this perpetual problem. But fertilizing your lawn, watering your lawn, raising your mower deck again, trying to get that crabgrass out of there would be your main goal. But yes, you can. The other place you can get corn gluten meal a lot of times is feed stores, because it's also used as an animal feed. And a lot of times it's packaged in bigger containers and it's cheaper.
Yeah,
but it's
cheaper.
The same thing. So, and again, it's like a granular thing. You put it in your spreader and you spread it on your lawn just like any other kind of crabgrass preventer.
Well, I'm going to check this out. So
yeah.
I thank you very much for your answers.
Good luck.
Appreciate it, Phil. Thank you for calling. Jim in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to know when to trim my, or how to, and when to prune my lilac bush. It blooms in the spring.
Yep.
Is it an old-fashioned lilac, or is it one of the newer, smaller type?
Well, it's about, I think, like 8 feet tall, and it's only like 4 years old.
Okay, so it's a big one. The thing with lilacs is, really, as far as the plant is concerned, you can prune them anytime. They're not real fussy. But you have to remember that the flower buds for the spring are formed the year before. So we always suggest that the best time to prune your lilacs is right after the flowers are gone. So, you know, that might be June, late June maybe, because then all the flower buds will form on stuff that's left behind, and that's your flowers for the next year. Okay? So you can prune it right now. As far as the plant is concerned, it's not going to kill the plant or anything, but you'll be pruning away flower buds, so you'll have less flowers at this time of year. And the best way to prune lilacs is that every year, you know, they have multiple stems that come up from the base.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to do it is every year kind of look at how many stems are at the base and prune away a few of the biggest, oldest ones. So if you had 10 stems coming out of the ground, prune out two or three of the biggest, fattest ones, because the flowers come on the younger wood. If we let the plant get older and barkier and corkier, those stems don't produce as many flowers. So if you take out 1/4 or 1/5 of the stems to the ground every year, that causes new shoots to come up from the base. And so you always have a plant that's on the young side, and those are the ones that produce the most flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so after they get done blooming.
That's right? The best time, for flower production.
Whack them off right at the base.
And that gluten meal, is that good for the garden too?
Yep, it is. It can really be effective in stopping weed seeds from germinating in the garden as well.
And your garden seeds.
Right. Well, that's the thing to remember is in your vegetable garden, you don't want to put that where you're planting your carrots or peas from seed. You would only put it around like transplants, like around tomatoes or broccoli that you transplant in, or you have to wait until your desired vegetable plants that you plant from seed, like your carrots, are a couple inches high before you put it around there, because it can't tell the difference between a weed and a vegetable.
Nope. There you go, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Tony in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My question is kind of along the lines you had a little earlier with the prairie garden stuff.
Yep.
Could you, you know, instead of using a herbicide, could you just desod it? I mean, just take the sod off?
Well, yeah, like with a sod cutter.
Yeah.
You can, but unfortunately that sod cutter only cuts so deep. And so my experience has been that there's still some roots that shoot up then. So,
and
I think in the caller's situation, I think he said he had a 40,000 square foot lawn or something, which is pretty big.
Much
and that's
than me.
Yeah. So if it was a smaller area, you could, and you could like cut the sod off and then just wait and see if anything's sprouting up and, you know, just spritz that rather than killing everything off. But unfortunately the grass roots very often go a little bit deeper than the sod cutter goes. So it's not always as effective as you want it to be.
Yeah. I thought about that, but 40,000 square feet. I thought, oh
yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure
that's
somebody has one that's tractor pulled or something.
Thanks, Tony.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yeah, and that's, you know, you're also taking away some soil there, too.
You are, but it's very thin. You know, I remember back in college taking a field trip to a sod farm up in Minnesota, and they said that they had been in business for like 70 years. And I thought, well, how come every year you're cutting off sod? How come there's not a big hole here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you're really just taking off a tiny bit of soil, and a lot of it is thatch and roots and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, they spread a little bit of compost on top, and the field never gets, you know, lower because... Mm-hmm. The sod cutters just don't
hold back,
right? And the sod cutters just don't go that deep into the soil.
Yeah, well, that makes good sense.
Mm-hmm.
We would. We had a Facebook question from Bob, who would like to establish some serviceberry trees on their fondle or lac de flambeau property. When would you plant those serviceberries, and what soil composition do they prefer, and how much sun? Well, they like a lot of sun.
They can take part shade. Serviceberries are a native shrub or native tree. Yeah. They come, when we buy them in the nurseries, you can get them as shrubs that only get 6 feet tall, and then you can get a couple different cultivars that get taller. But they're pretty adaptable soil-wise. They're not probably going to like a real sandy, dry situation. If you can plant them anytime, if they're coming in a container, if you're getting them bare root, like if you're buying a lot of them through a nursery and getting them bare root, you'll get them when they're dormant, and you want to get them planted ASAP because you can't have those roots out there. But if you're buying them or getting them in a pot or in a container, you can plant them pretty much any time of year as long as you water them in well once you plant them. And they're great shrubs. Cedar waxwings will love you for planting them.
Yeah, well, they make good jam, too.
They do, if you can get them before the cedar waxwings do.
What about starting a garden in an established lawn area? You want to kill the grass again, don't you?
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing where you've got to get that grass out of there. Otherwise, those rhizomes, those roots will be sprouting up all over the place. And that will be a problem forever until you get that out of there. So now a lot of people, like if it's in a vegetable garden, they don't want to use glyphosate or Roundup on there.
Sure.
Because they don't want to have any kind of stuff like that in the vegetable garden. So if the garden's not too big, you can, that's a place where, you know, you could use the sod cutter. You can hand pull out sod. Otherwise, you can till it and till it and till it. You can just dig that sod out. You want to get most of it out. And then once you get things planted, you have to be really diligent about any little sprouts of grass that sprout up, getting them out of there really quickly before they have underground roots going all over the place.
Mulch the heck out of it.
Right. That'll smother some of it too. The nice thing about a vegetable garden is you can till it up every year. So if you do get a grass patch, it's not as bad as like in a raspberry patch or a strawberry patch where you don't till it up every year. But grass is highly, highly competitive with everything. And it's a difficult thing to get rid of.
Diana Alfeth, our guest today. She is the horticulture educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension. She works out of Pierce County. And she also teaches landscape design at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller with Diana Alfeth for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening is a great outlet, isn't it? It's always good to get your hands dirty, and I know you've been waiting a long time, like me, through the winter to get back out into the garden. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Diana Alfeth, our guest. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Always great to have her with us. She teaches a landscape design class as well at UW River Falls. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on my Facebook page as well at The Larry Mueller Show. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Diana, thanks again for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
It's always great to be here.
Tom in Whitewater has a question for you, so let's go to Tom. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. In my ongoing and very unsuccessful battle with tomato blight, I've decided to put copper sulfate into the arsenal. In looking online, I see a variety of ways that it's used, solutions of just copper sulfate crystals, copper sulfate and lime mixes, and pre-mixed things that are used. I have a plot for about 16 or 18 Roma tomatoes, and I'm wondering where's a good place to start in terms of trying to use copper sulfate?
Well, copper and sulfate are fungicides, and most of tomato blight is kind of a general term, and it's caused by various organisms, a couple of fungus, septoria leaf spot is in there, and so it's kind of a general term. But if you, people get a lot of success just with a copper-based fungicide that you buy at the garden center, and then just, to list that it's for tomatoes, and then you spray it on the foliage. You have to start before the blight starts, okay? because fungicides are protectants. They don't cure a fungus. They have to be on the leaf before the spore germinates and takes hold and starts growing. Okay, so you need to start kind of early in the season before you start seeing symptoms. And you usually, you know, you just follow the label instructions, but usually it means that you mix it into a liquid form, whether it's a powder or a granular. You dissolve it in liquid. You spray it on. Usually it's every like 7 to 10 days. And it can be very, very effective, but you have to make sure that you coat the plants well, you coat the top and bottoms of the leaves. And besides just, you know, relying on the fungicide, make sure that you rotate your tomatoes so that they're not growing in the same soil that you grew tomatoes or eggplants or potatoes in the previous year or previous 2 years, ideally, because you'll have less exposure to the pathogen then. Make sure you space your tomatoes so that when they are full grown and producing in August, they are not touching each other, so you're getting good air circulation there. You can prune off lower branches to get more air circulation. Mulch around the plants so that water or irrigation doesn't splash soil up on the bottom leaves, because that's how it often gets started, because these things hang out in the soil. And ideally, water the soil, not the leaves, so the soaker hose kind of a thing. And with all of those cultural things and adding in the fungicide, you should be able to have blight-free tomatoes.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Tom. Or you can grow them in a straw bale like I do.
Right, and that's a thing. You know, a lot of times people have had such struggle. You know, the organisms are in their soil. They can't break that cycle. They don't have enough room to rotate enough. So plant your tomatoes in a container or a straw bale or some other kind of a thing. Rent a community garden plot for a year and grow your tomatoes out there and in soil that doesn't have the history of tomato blight, and kind of break that cycle a little bit, and that can really be helpful.
Bill in Stanley, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope you can help. I've got a very mature box elder tree in my backyard that provides great afternoon shade for my house. About 3 years ago, I had a guy come in and he trimmed off all the dead limbs, which were quite a few. Since the snow has finally melted, I've seen that there is a great accumulation of bark on the ground from the tree. Is there anything I can do to prevent woodpeckers from attacking the tree and killing it?
No. actually, the woodpeckers aren't attacking and killing the tree. If the bark is coming off, you had all those dead limbs, chances are that tree is kind of on its downhill side of life, and it's dying for other reasons. Box elders aren't super long-lived trees. They're kind of weak, and they do this.
There's a reason the woodpeckers are attacking the tree is because there are insects
exactly
in the tree
and under that bark. So if that bark is popping off, that bark is loosening up, there's probably insect larvae and things down there, and that's what the woodpeckers are after. And they peck away at the wood and make holes, but usually that wood is not strong, healthy wood. That's wood that's already dying and it's softening up, and they're just picking out the insects that are in there already. So controlling the woodpeckers isn't going to save the tree. It's probably just that you better start a tree nearby to grow up and start getting some shade in your yard, because that box elder tree is probably going to get weaker and weaker and shabbier looking every year and just not be around that much longer.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Unfortunate, but true.
Yep.
It provides great afternoon shade for our house, which the bedrooms face the west, and that's the only shade we have for the house.
Yeah. Plant something fast growing. I don't know what your soil is like and stuff, but think about like river birch. They're relatively fast growing and they're beautiful trees. And right now we don't have any major disease or insect problems with river birch. So that might be a good option. Depending on your soil and your conditions, I'm assuming obviously that it's full sun. So, but whatever you do, plant, you know, you might plant two trees and plant two different things, because we never know what disease or insect will come along.
One on each side of that tree.
That's right.
There you go. Good luck, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. You really ought to consider that if you want to get some shade eventually again. Dick in Hatley, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Great show series. I try to listen every week if I can. We got plum trees. We got two trees in the backyard, and they're, I think it's the red plum. They're about 12, 13 years old, and every spring we get just an absolute ton of blossoms, totally white. The blossoms, I mean, the fruit sets, and so I think the fruit is getting pollinated, and it gets to be about a quarter inch in diameter. These trees, like I said, I think I said 12, 13 years old, so they're old trees, but when they get to be about a quarter inch, maybe a little bigger, about 95%+ of the fruit falls off, and we're lucky if we get four or five plums. We've tried, I mean, we've fertilized with the fruit tree fertilizer pretty regularly. I've tried pruning from light, medium, and heavy. I just pruned the bejeebers out of it a couple of years ago, and yeah, same thing happened over again. So what else can we try?
Well, fruit can drop for a number of reasons, and pollination is one of them. And even, you know, it still might be a pollination issue, but it could also be a weather issue. So if the temperature drops or gets really too hot or something at just the right time, that can cause them to drop. It might be that the tree itself is just not real healthy. So fruit trees will self-thin because they'll blossom, they'll get all these baby fruit there, and then they'll realize, hey, I don't have enough energy to support all of those. So we always get some drop in June, whether it's plums or cherries or apples and stuff. So your tree might be thinking, oh, I got to get rid of almost all this fruit because I don't have enough energy or ability to support them. So it could be that. So making sure that your tree is healthy. You might do a soil test around it to see if you're missing anything important there and that you're sure that you have, you know, all the major nutrients there. The other thing is that insects can be getting them even when they're that small. And plum curculio is one of the most common insects that it gets apples as well, but obviously it's named plum curculio for a reason. But it can lay its eggs on those fruit when they're even that tiny, and sometimes that can then cause them to drop. So and you said you had two trees, but they're different varieties?
No, they're the same. They're the same variety, and there's two trees, and we've had this same thing happen for probably about 8 years. I've never gotten a good crop.
Yeah,
it's a multi-year thing, and I have never seen a good crop, and it's the same routine every year. So.
Yeah. You might consider adding a third plum tree to the mix, something that's a different variety, so that you're getting pollen from a different variety, and that might help too because some of the plums are partially self-fertile, meaning they can pollinate themselves, and some of them benefit from pollination from a different variety. So that might help to strengthen that pollination, and, you know, if pollination is a problem, and it can be. So, and usually, you know, when we get plums dropping, it's usually when they're like marble size, really, you know, really small. And your trees are old enough, so they should be, you know, we see more fruit drop on younger trees, again, because they really aren't ready to support a big crop and stuff. But
I just wonder if I'd be better off to start with new ones, if there's a genetic problem or something like that, just start all over again.
I wouldn't start over. I'd add another one with a different pollen.
All right.
Well. And then if that doesn't work, then you can whack off the two and add two more new ones with the other one.
And one of the plums that is very often used for pollinating is called toka, T-O-K-A. It gets plums, but it's just solid flowers, and it's a really good pollinator. So it's very often sold to be the pollinator for other plums.
Good luck, Dick. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Scott in Eau Claire, hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. Say, I got a long question. My backyard, we moved in the house a few years ago, and the front yard is real nice. The backyard doesn't look like he took as much care. It's real kind of knobby in areas, or it's very, you know, it's uneven, and I know in the kids there sometimes they trip. It's like the grass is, like, mounded up, and I tried, like, seeding, you know, overseeding to try to raise it up. Thought about drenching it and rolling it, but the neighbor said that he tried that also. I'm just kind of wondering what would be a good way to try to level that lawn out. I mean, you know, by the, I mean, looking at it, it looks fine, but, you know, under the grass, it's...
Have you added soil in those low spots or around those knobby spots?
It almost looks like the grass is just kind of clumped up, which
maybe it's...
Okay. So if it's not actually soil that's clumping that up, then it's probably a different species of grass, some kind of a clump-forming grass. And it could be... So you should look at those spots and see if the blades of grass look different. And you can, if you can identify that grass, and you know, you can take it into your local extension office too, and help, they can help you identify it. But if you got like a clump of orchard grass or some other kind of clumpy grass that gets a big crown on it, that could be what's raised up. And then when you mow, does it kind of like scalp that kind of area?
Yeah, if I drop my blade way down, because the grass in the front yard is definitely different than the grass in the backyard.
Yeah.
The neighbor said that he planted some no mow or something in the front yard because I have to mow my backyard like 3 or 4 times to every time I mow my front yard once.
Okay, yeah. So you're definitely dealing with different species of grasses. If those high areas are actually soil, then like Larry said, if you can just, you know, spread an inch of topsoil on the lower spots and you can kind of smooth it out, that's one option. You can also try like running an aerator over it several times, and that'll pull up a lot of chunks, and then you can drag it and try to smooth them out a little bit. But if it's actually a different species of grass forming those clumps, then what I would do would take an herbicide like glyphosate, Roundup again, and just spray those areas, kill that grass in that spot that's raised up there, and then in the backyard there, those high areas that you're tripping on, if it's basically a big crown of grass that's raised up above the soil level, kill that clump out and then reseed it with probably a bluegrass or a fescue or a mix sort of a thing, and get rid of that crown. So, you know, if it's a different species of grass that's causing the problem, that's what you got to do to get rid of it.
Yep. Good luck to you, Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Mark in Baldwin. Hi.
Hi. I have a very fast-growing woody vine that is in several spots in my 3-acre yard that is climbing trees and is killing them off. I have no idea what it is, and I'd love to be able to get rid of it.
Does it turn really, the leaves turn really bright scarlet red in the fall?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Have you looked at the leaves? Is it like a palm shape, like there's 5 leaves coming out of one central area?
That's kind of close. I wish it were leafing right now. I could describe
it
better.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably Parthenocissus quinquefolia, which is... commonly called Engelmann ivy. It's got a couple other common names to it. It's a native vine, and we have a lot up in Pierce St. Croix County areas. And it'll get little blue-black fruits on it in the fall with bright red stems on the fruits. And so it grows up, you know, is it growing up... what's it growing up? You said it's killing trees.
Well, it almost infested my lilac bush.
Okay.
Which is probably about 100 feet long.
And then it can kind of ramble all over it and kind of swallow it up.
Exactly.
So, So, what you do is you take your pruners and your little can of Roundup again. Boy, I'm talking about Roundup again a lot this year, or brush killer or something like that. And just go down and find the base of that vine. And cut it off right at ground level and treat that cut stem, that cut stump, with an herbicide. Just put it on the cut area right away so that goes down and kills the root system so it doesn't sprout back up. And then you can just pull that vine out of your shrubs and trees and stuff. The thing is, it is a native plant. The seeds get spread around by birds and everything. They sprout up all over the place. It's a never-ending thing. It's a weed. But if you can catch them when they're small before they really ramble up on everything, that's the thing to do. But like I said, if you just prune it off, it's just going to resprout from that root system and continue to be a problem. So you kind of have to kill that root with an herbicide.
And I hate to ask this. You gave me the horticultural name for it, but there was also a vernacular. What was that again?
Virginia, I think it's called Virginia creeper sometimes, but it's Engelmann ivy. You can actually buy it in the nursery as a nursery plant. People intentionally plant these things, believe it or not. But it is a native plant, so it's not considered
invasive.
But Engelmann ivy, I think
Virginia creeper
is another name, and there's a couple other common names for it as well.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Paul, we have another corn and gluten question, so let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, I've been collecting empty feed sacks from the agri-service all winter to use as a mulch in the vegetable garden, and most of, or the, at least the best feed sacks contain corn gluten meal, and I'm wondering if the trace amounts of meal that's left in the bags might keep plants from growing or keep seeds from germinating.
Probably not. When you put corn gluten meal on your soil to control weeds, you know, it's a little granules and you need like a several granules per square inch. So you put it on relatively thick. So I don't think there'd probably be enough dust left in those bags to really be effective that way. But the feed sacks, the paper, is a great mulch. That'll keep weed seeds from germinating. And because they're paper, they can rot and actually usually be worked into the soil later on to add organic matter. So those are real good ways to help with weed control.
Yeah.
Okay. And another quick question about composted manure analysis. I'm wondering, I have manure from poultry mixed with straw, and it's never been analyzed before. It just gets left outside. And I turned it a couple of times in the past year. And I'm wondering if I should get the compost analysis. I realize it's just going to tell me how much nitrogen and phosphorus and whatever it has in it, but is it worth it to do it?
Are you just going to use it like in your personal vegetable garden sort of a thing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't either. The thing is that manure varies depending on the animal it came out of, how long it's been sitting, what the diet of the animal was. Generally speaking, manure is lower in nitrogen than commercial fertilizers would be. And it's loaded with phosphorus and potassium, and it's got all those trace minerals in it because the animals ate those plants that had the trace minerals in it. The best thing about compost is it adds organic matter. It improves your soil structure. Depending on how your plants are performing, you might use some extra nitrogen fertilizer because, again, compost is usually not high in
although
nitrogen.
Poultry manure is
higher than some of the others.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But there's not really any major reason to test it before you use it.
So if it looks good, go ahead and use it?
Yeah.
And especially if it's composted to the point where you can't really recognize what it originally was, if it's been, out and about for a while.
Yeah, all I can see is little pieces of straw in it at this point.
Yeah. It sounds like a wonderful soil amendment.
Okay great. Thank you
all
very
right.
much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, you kind of want it. Don't want it in your vegetable garden if it's not.
We actually Extension has a fact sheet on using manure in vegetable gardens because of the concern about E. coli and other pathogens that might get on the vegetables, and then you don't wash the vegetables well enough, you eat it, and the human health issues with that. But if it's been composted, especially if it's been allowed to heat up nice, most of that stuff is killed. Or if it's applied to the vegetable garden well before when you're going to harvest your vegetables. So, but if it's not very recognizable anymore, that's what you want.
In 30 seconds, can you tell us, give us advice for growing carrots in clay loam soil?
Lots and lots of that aforementioned compost. So if you have a clay soil, the carrots, the roots can't push through there. They'll fork and they'll be short and stubby. And really what you have to do is loosen up that soil. And lots of organic matter is what you do to do that. So.
Well, you have given us a wealth of information today, Diana. Thank you so much. It's been great fun.
It has been fun. I enjoyed it.
Well, I hope we have a chance. We will have a chance to do it again.
Sure.
As long as you're willing and able.
The growing season is just beginning.
Diana Alfeth is the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. Somebody called and said, oh, man, she's doing a great job. And I agree. She has done a great job. She will be back and will be with us again. I'm sure of it. Monday at 11, we'll talk with Michelle Wildgen, a Madison-based writer who's written a new novel. It's really an interesting one. It's called Bread and Butter. Just finished it recently. We'll also explore the wonderful world of wine with Jessica Bell. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.